This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Susan Hawthorne. Dr. Susan Hawthorne is an Australian radical ecofeminist lesbian. She joined the Women's Liberation Movement in 1973, and it changed her life for the better. She's a poet, novelist, and feminist theorist with degrees in philosophy, ancient Greek, Sanskrit, and a PhD in women's studies / political science. She's the author of 9 collections of poetry, 3 works of fiction, and 5 nonfiction books. Her books have been translated into 5 languages. She's worked in publishing for more than 30 years and is an adjunct professor in the School of Humanities at James Cook University, Townsville. She lives in tropical Queensland, surrounded by wildlife, cassowaries, goannas, wallabies, lots of butterflies, and lush vegetation. The publishing website, her publishing website is www.spinifexpress.com.au, Facebook, Spinifex Press, Twitter handle, Spinifex Press. Her most recent book is Vortex, The Crisis of Patriarchy. And we talked once before, which I really enjoyed. And so first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being in the program.
Thank you, Derek. It's great to talk to you.
So about 25 years ago, I interviewed Judith Herman, the extraordinary person who wrote Trauma and Recovery. And one of the things she talked about was I'm blanking on the name. The person who did the studies of different of high and low rape cultures, Peggy Reeve-Sandé. She mentioned Peggy Reeve-Sandé and Peggy Reeve-Sandé studying why some cultures are high rape and some are low rape. And she listed some of the characteristics, and some of them were obvious, like if it's highly militarized, it's probably a high rape culture. If women are treated poorly in general, it's probably a high rape culture, and on and on. And one of them she said was that if there is a male creator deity instead of a female creator deity or a couple creator deity, that it's probably a high rape, that could be a marker of a high rape culture. And then Judith Herman threw in an offhand comment afterwards. She said, and that really is counterintuitive to have a male creator deity. And this line has haunted me for 25 years, and I'm hoping you can, exercise this haunting or help me understand this. It is tremendously counterintuitive, and I'm wondering if you can help us all understand it.
Well, it's really interesting that you start with that, because I've been trying to just pull my thoughts together in preparation for this interview. And, you know, one of the things that happens in the transition from what I would call women-centered or matrifocal or matrilineal cultures to patriarchy is a huge increase in rape and rape stories and rape mythologies. In fact, I was just writing some notes before, and you know, the rape story happens again and again and again as patriarchy comes in. That's the first thing that happens. It's really hard to know where to start because it's so huge. I mean, the story of the shift from society that respects women and has a female deity or a multiplicity of female deities to patriarchy takes up several hundred thousand years. So the shift began to happen, or started to happen, I guess, around about 6,000 years ago. That's not the case all around the world, and it's certainly true that patriarchy is neither universal nor inevitable, and there are some remaining cultures that are not patriarchal, but Peggy Reeve-Sandé would have more to say about that. She's better informed than I am on that level. But let me just talk a little bit about Greece. How I started to get into this was back in 1976, early 77, I travelled to Greece. I had just finished university and, like all Australians, took off. Going to Greece really, really changed my mindset. I particularly went to Crete. I went to the museum in Heraklion. And if you have the right mindset, if you have an open mind, you walk into that museum and you can see immediately that the women-centered or women-respecting culture of the Minoans, badly named because Minos was a king and it had nothing to do with him, that the culture of the Minoans is truly extraordinary. It's artistic. There are no fortifications visible on the island of Crete. The images and figurines of women are everywhere. There are hardly any male figures, and it just shifted something in my brain. I then returned to Australia and I began studying Greek. In the process of studying Greek, I also attempted to do a PhD on precisely this topic, which was the nature of the structure of belief systems in the ancient world. And what I was going to do was to write about the way in which the belief system shifted in this moment of patriarchy coming in. In Greece, the most well-known story of the transition is the one of Athena, which you get in the plays, where in the Oresteia plays, where Athena makes a decision that the killing of the father is a far worse crime than the killing of the mother. And it's really interesting because the killing of the matricide or the killing of the mother was a key thing that you could be punished for the rest of your life for. And you would be pursued by the Erinnes or the Furies. You would not live a peaceful life. This came after the battle with Troy. Now, Troy was probably a matrilineal society. It was based, the area where Troy was is now in Turkey, which at that time you would call Anatolia, or, you know, various other things. And Anatolia had a very long history of women-respecting societies. It's also where some of the Amazons come from. You know, it's huge. I almost don't know which sentence to say next because it's so big. The war in Troy happened because Paris, who was a real upstart, and up himself, he went off with Helen. Now, Helen was actually a very smart Spartan and sister to Clytemnestra. And she was married to a real deadhead, Menelaus, who was the brother of Agamemnon. Agamemnon then decides Menelaus decides there has to be a war, and Agamemnon leads the troops off to Troy. They have 10 years of fighting, 10 years. On the way, they sacrifice Agamemnon and Clytemnestra's daughter, Iphigenia. So there's all these terrible things that are going on. After 10 years, the Odysseus, who's a smart ass, decides that what they need to do is they need to make an offering and they need to trick the Trojans. So they build a wooden horse as an offering to Troy because they can't get into the city. The walls are just too high. So they do this, and inside, Cassandra has been saying, "Don't accept this, Troy. Don't. It's a trick. Please don't bring it in." The problem with Cassandra was that although she had the ability to see the future, nobody would believe her. And the reason for this was that she knocked back Apollo, who wanted to have sex with her, in other words, wanted to rape her without her permission, and she refused. And so he said, nobody is ever going to believe your prophecies from now on. It's a real Me Too moment, I think. Anyway, so the horse comes, the wooden horse comes in. It is filled with Greek soldiers. In the meantime, the ships of the Greek soldiers have headed off and disappeared from the shoreline, and the Trojans are going, what's going on? Well, this must be a genuine offering to us to say, you know, let's stop the war. But it was a trick, and Odysseus and the soldiers that were inside the wooden horse decide that that once it got dark, that they will come out and they will kill the people, ravage the city and so forth, which is precisely what they do. They set the city on fire. The whole place is not demolished, but it is so many people are killed, people are taken as slaves. Cassandra becomes one of those slaves, and so on. So Cassandra becomes a slave to Agamemnon, and when Agamemnon returns to Greece, you know, he's you know, really pleased because he's won the war, and you know, Greek manhood is up there. And so he goes in and into the palace where Clytemnestra with her lover of the time Aegisthus are, and Clytemnestra arranges to have Agamemnon killed. Cassandra has been saying to him, don't go in, don't go in. He didn't believe her, of course. So because Clytemnestra has Agamemnon killed, that then becomes the basis of the statement of Athena, because in response to that, Orestes, who is the son of Clytemnestra and Agamemnon, kills Clytemnestra. So there's the killing of the husband by Clytemnestra killing Agamemnon, and then there's the killing of Clytemnestra by her son Orestes, and he is then pursued by the Erinnes or Furies, and Athena has to make a decision, and she makes the decision that actually matricide is a very, very bad thing, and far worse than the killing of Agamemnon, which is interesting because in the case of Clytemnestra killing Agamemnon, she is not killing a blood relative. She is killing a husband, a consort, sexual partner, etc. Whereas Orestes is killing his own blood mother. And that is the really critical difference. But Athena, the goddess who had been born from the head of Zeus in the later Greek mythology, comes down on the side of the patriarchy. So the thing is, you know, this is, you really, it's complicated because you really have to know all the names of the people, and you have to understand the family connections and the genealogy and all of that. And it really takes a while to get your head around it. So that's the starting point.
So thank you for that. And let's back up just a little bit. And can you give us a couple of, or at least one, female creator, female deity creator stories?
Well, there are a huge number. The Greek one, the oldest of them, is Eurynome. And she is the goddess who laid the egg, the cosmic egg. And out of that came the world. There are stories of that kind all around. And lots of different cultures have very similar stories of a creator goddess who is the origin of all things. And then, you know, then there are generations of different gods who come out of that. And Zeus is in the line quite a long way down, you know, several generations after that. So the matriarchs, goddesses like Rhea, who's the flow, that's a word that means flow. And, you know, so that I read that as, you know, these are the stars, the Milky Way and all of those sorts of things. So this is the big picture, and you get the Milky Way appearing in lots of stories, or the stars and you know, the heavenly bodies, let's call them.
And are the heavenly bodies at that point considered female?
Yes. Not all, but a vast majority of them, yes.
And then this transition of taking several generations until the – well, let's stop for a second and go with – now can you give a couple examples of male creator deity stories?
Well, they come very late. I mean, the Christian story is, you know, it's only 2,000 years old. Although if you go back the Old Testament, I guess it goes back further than that. It's actually, in terms of creator, in the Greeks didn't really have male creator gods. I mean, Zeus does, you know, he creates Athena out of his head, but that's as good as it gets. Ares, his brother, is the god of war, and Hades is the god of the underworld. So there's not a lot of creation going on there. In India, you do get creator gods. Now I'm having a blank myself. It'll come to me soon. And Brahma is one of them. And the thing is that all of the creator gods have to do other things because, in fact, they are incapable of creating from themselves. They have to have some kind of trick that creates things. Like, you know, Yahweh, the Christian god, you know, creates Adam out of dirt. Eve was actually around long before Adam, the precursor to Eve was Lilith, who was a Hebrew goddess. There are so many names. You know, I'm trying to rack my brain all the names of the ones I haven't thought about for a while. And, you know, it's really quite extraordinary. The patriarchy, and I think patriarchy is still doing this, does a lot of appropriation and creates different ways, different illusions, I think, of creation that are not really creation. And there's a lot of killing that goes on. I mean, Marduk in the Near East, he is a god who comes in and kills the goddess. So there is killing, there is rape, there is trickery. All of these things happen across a whole lot of different cultural traditions.
So I'm gonna throw something out, and let me know if you think this is okay or nonsense. That it has always struck me that in the Bible it talks about in the beginning was the Word, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we have the notion of Zeus creating Athena emerging from his head. And mm-hmm. one of the problems with patriarchy, it has seemed to me, is that it values what we think over what is real. And
yes.
It seems to me that one of the things I love about mythology is that for a myth to stick, even when it's a mythology that's fundamentally destructive, it still has to tell basic psychological and social truths. And so it's like they can't help but reveal from the very, very, very beginning that in patriarchy, what we create from our mind is or from our brain is more important than what is created by the body or the body of the earth. That's like the entire not all of patriarchy, but a lot of patriarchy is condensed into those few words. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree. Patriarchy has a tendency to reify the abstract as opposed to the material. And you can see that in the so-called birth stories of patriarchy as opposed to the genuine birth stories of female-centered societies. I mean, women genuinely do give birth, and you can see who that. You can also trace lineages back through female lines. Whereas when you have patriarchy, you know, the men can never really be sure if they are the father. And in order to be sure about that, they have to institute, you know, really strong laws that make it impossible for women to have any other sexual partners or to give birth to children who are the offspring of other men. So there are a whole lot of things that come along with that. And one of the other interesting stories is the story of Medea. And Medea also comes from a society in which women have more power, although her father is the king. But she is a very smart, smart woman. She has knowledge of herbs. She is called a witch, which means that, you know, she's got a PhD in that period. She helps Jason comes to her place in Colchis, and he's been told he has to collect the golden fleece. So, but in order to do this, he needs help because he can't actually do it on his own. So Medea provides all sorts of opportunities for him to do the various things he needs to do in order to get the golden fleece. She then departs her homeland of Colchis with Jason and goes to his homeland, in Corinth, you know, that very tiny, it's the space between North and South Greece. On the way, in order to stop the pursuit of their boat, she kills her brother and cuts him up and spreads him across the sea. Now, that's not a nice thing to do, but, you know, if you want to escape, you do bad things. But when she gets to Corinth, while Jason has been saying all these marvellous things to her and how fantastic she is, and in the meantime, they've had two sons, he then goes off with the local princess, Glauca, I think is her name, and decides that he's going to marry her. So what's happened is that Medea has lost her ground because she has left her homeland. She is no longer attached to the place called home. Instead, she is in this foreign place called Corinth, which is a long way away in terms of sailing time, from Colchis at the other end of the Mediterranean. He decides he's going to marry this princess, you know, he will have her sons and they will grow up with them. So it's also a story about theft of children, which is another repeating theme. She then decides to react against this, but she does it by trickery. She offers a beautiful dress to the princess, who puts it on, and because of her knowledge of herbs and poisons and stuff, the dress kills the princess. And she also, of course, Jason is furious, but she also kills their two sons, because it is clear to Medea that if the sons live, then she will not be considered the mother. So there's all these battles going on. Medea has lost everything by taking off with this hero Jason, but Jason also loses because he loses the new wife to be. He also loses his children. Eventually, he's hit on the head by a piece of wood from one of the ships. So, and actually, Medea, according to the play, is rescued and carried off in a flying chariot, which is a rather nice into the story. She then goes down to Athens and lives there for many years. So that's another whole story.
So in many of these stories, It's necessary for the new male who takes over to dramatically kill the older. Well, first to sort of demonize the older female deities, and then to kill them.
Yes.
Like, isn't that the story of Medusa, kind of? And also, there's the, you mentioned Marduk. Is that the story with Tiamat the dragon?
Yes,
also?
Yes, yeah.
And so can you talk about that both mythologically and also, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, oh God, this is a really unfair question, but, oh, and I'm even sorry to ask it, but in some ways I'm not sorry to ask it, is how are myths created? How does this, what is the interplay between what's happening in physical reality and that, and the stories that are told? How, I know this is ridiculous, but does one precede the other? Do they move in a mutually reinforcing cycle? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I think myths are created through storytelling. And storytelling is carried on down through the line with very important methods. So they're involved in it in order to make sure that a story remains true to its origins. First of all, you create music, because if you then put words to music, it is easier to remember them. You might also create symbolic prompts, and that's where the work of somebody like Maria Gimbutas comes in, where she has discovered all these different symbols that are used as a kind of language in the prehistory, that is prior to writing, but they are forms of writing. It's just that we don't know what they, how they sound. And she pretty much works out what they mean, but not how they sound. So there are things like dance, music, song, symbolic treatment to help things record, poetry are all really, really critical in terms of these stories being memorized. And I think that's the reason why many of them still exist, even the old ones prior to writing and prior to patriarchy. We still know so many of these stories. Now, when patriarchy comes in, a lot of what happens is that those, let's call them village stories, community stories, regional stories, become are destroyed through warfare mostly. So whole villages will be wiped out. And then the winners always get to tell the story. So they create a new story. But you always have this substratum of the old stories where people have survived. I mean, there's some fantastic books around that people can read, I mean, or websites. I mean, Max Dashu has a wonderful website called the Suppressed Histories Archive, which he's been putting together over 50-odd years. Beautiful stuff. And you can see all around the world. Miriam Robbins Dexter on her source book of goddesses has all of this information. Marianne Beavis and Helen Huang have a wonderful anthology about myth and history and culture, goddesses in myth, history and culture. And Judy Foster, whose book we published at Spin Effects, Invisible Women of Prehistory, also goes around the world with her stories. And then there are more specialist ones like Giti Tadani talking about the ancient lesbian history in India, which is just fantastic. So going back to the stories, I think I've kind of made that clear. What happens is stories are created, they live, and the original stories lived for thousands and thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. But then at some point when patriarchy moves into the area, they get mostly destroyed. Patriarchy puts in its own stories, And I think, you know, they kind of make it clear that you believe or you're dead.
So you have we're gonna make up a mythology here. So you have a community where the creator deity is called Judy. Okay, it's the Judy is the creator of the world, and then that town gets, or that community gets conquered by a warlike people who probably have a male creator deity, and then in the aftermath of that, they have to tell stories that Judy was not a wise mother, but instead was a horrible demon who did horrible things to everybody and tortured everybody. And then the world was actually created by the male god Fred. Sorry for the stupid names. The male god Fred, who then in order to show his superiority over Judy, probably also raped her and murdered her. I mean, that could be a plausible, and so that's just sort of propaganda to destroy what vestiges there are of the belief in the old religion. Is this remotely possible?
Yes. It's not just remotely possible, it's the basic plan. And there are demons. There is a real flourishing of demons that who arrive into the world at the origins of patriarchy. Lilith becomes a demon. Many of the in the world of India, as we know it. I mean, there's a flourishing of demons there, and the demonic is something that happens everywhere. I mean, in Rome, when the creation of Rome as we know it now, the mother of Romulus and Remus, whose name was Ilia, she was raped by the god Mars. She didn't want to be raped, of course. But as a result, she became pregnant. And when she was pregnant, she was then imprisoned and chained because the patriarchs did not want that lineage to exist. They didn't want the children of her to come into existence. Those children then, when they were born, that's Romulus and Remus, they were taken by a shepherd down to the river Tiber and left there. He was meant to kill them, but he didn't have the heart, so he left them there. They were then adopted by the she-wolf, Lupa, who took them to a cave and raised them. And you see that the image of Rome is Lupa, the wolf, suckling Romulus and Remus. But Romulus and Remus were just as bad because Romulus was the one who set up the rape of the Sabine women. The whole story is a complete setup where Romulus provides the opportunity for the Sabine women to be raped. He then has a court. There's a kind of court case that's a bit like a Trumpian court case. It's really terrible. So the Sabine women become the ones who are blamed for the rape, not the perpetrators. So that's a demonization of those women within a historic period. Then they don't all happen in the prehistoric period. And I've written about a lot of this. I mean, that particular story, or those stories I write about in my poetry collection, Lupa and Lamb. That's kind of how I've been working with these stories. I did try to do a PhD back in 1979 on this subject, as I mentioned before, but nobody was ready. Nobody within within the academic world was ready. So I left that and I started writing fiction and subsequently poetry. And because I've been writing it in that way, it's possible to tell these stories. And I have the stories in my book Cow about the histories and the mythologies in India, where the cow has a really critical part to play. Like I said at the beginning, with the stars and so forth, the cow in my story, I mean, I call her Queenie, it's because the word queen is related to the word cow etymologically. But the cow says, you know, I'm obviously the creator of the universe because look, the Milky Way made up, they're the galaxies. The Greek word for milk is gala, which is where the word galaxy comes from. So I play with these stories. But there's also a whole lot of real research in the back of the stories that I tell. And in my more recent book, The Sacking of the Muses, I also tell stories from India and Rome and Greece, which draw on the different mythologies. That's that the Lupin and Lamb and Cow are kind of continuing stories, but Sacking of the Muses is a bit more. It's not a complete story in itself, although some people have said that it is. So you know, who knows? I think that the interesting thing is the way in which stories do persist. I mean, the cows in India these days, I mean, they are still the center of so many people's lives, both materially and spiritually. And in the Vedic era, there's a goddess called Ushas, or actually they're a collection of goddesses, and they are cows. And the speckled cow becomes a really important image in a lot of the stories and so forth. So I think it's really fascinating. But what makes the stories stick are things like poetry, song, images, dancing, various symbolic renditions of them, and you see them also in contemporary Indigenous cultures as well. They have methods of remembering stories. I mean, here in Australia, we have a very vibrant oral culture that the Indigenous people of Australia have.
Yeah, I used to have a friend who was a cowboy poet, and he talked about how if you tell a joke once, people will hear it once and they don't want to hear it again. But if you put it to rhyme, they want to hear it every night around the campfire. And then also I'm thinking about what some Indigenous people have said to me about the role of music in propagation, that music opens us up viscerally. It opens up our body to receive messages, which is one reason, frankly, that a lot of rock and roll really scares me, because you can have people playing power chords and opening up until you can have 100,000 people chanting at the same time, "I'm on the highway to hell." Mm-hmm. And it doesn't so much scare me as I just recognize that music itself is very powerful, and rhyme is very powerful, meter is very powerful. And they move us in ways I think that we often don't understand.
Yes, they do. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, why dactylic pentameters and various other meters, poetic meters, are very important. I mean, the stories that Homer, which is just an invented name really, tells in the Iliad and the Odyssey, the entire story is done in meter. Now, if you have meter and you have to tell this story out of your head, you don't have any notes in front of you. It's all in the memory. There are certain ways of creating systems that allow you to remember because of meter, there are various fillers, you know, the names of gods and goddesses, they get all these interesting adjectives in front of them. I mean, something like owl-eyed Athena or the wine dark sea. So you get these phrases that are there that if the poet can't quite remember what's going on, fills it in. And I did some work on the Homeric hymns to Aphrodite and to Demeter. And again, you know, those Homeric hymns are much shorter than the massive Iliad and Odyssey, but they tell really important stories, shorter stories about different goddesses. And in those stories, again, you see the transition. Not always from, I mean, by the time these stories are happening, patriarchy is already there. But what you see is the diminution of power for the goddesses. So Aphrodite, for example, has a sexual relationship with a human, Anchises. And at the beginning, you know, Aphrodite is this, you know, goddess who's got everything, you know, everybody literally loves her and she never falls in love with humans. She can't be won over. But in this instance, she is. So she has a sense of shame about that. Now, that's a new concept. That is not a concept that was around in an earlier time. And she loses power through the story. The story of Demeter has a similar analogous kind of dimension to it. Where, you know, Persephone, who's the daughter of Demeter, Demeter is the mother goddess, the cereal goddess, the farming goddess, all of those things. Persephone is out playing with her friends and looking at flowers. And Hades, the underworld, the god of the underworld and brother of Zeus, comes along and abducts her and takes her to his home, which is the underworld. Demeter doesn't know where Persephone has gone, and she can only find one person who will tell her that, and that's the other goddess, Hecate, who knows a lot more than she lets on. Anyway, so eventually they discover that Persephone is in the underworld, and Demeter wants her to leave. But the problem is, while she's there, she eats. She has red wine and she has the seeds of the pomegranate, which are red. And because of that, she can't leave forever. Demeter wants her to come up to the upper world and stay with her. But it's determined that she spends 6 months in the underworld and 6 months in the upper world. And during the time when she's in the upper world is when the fields are fertile and the crops grow and everything is flourishing. But then winter starts to come and she has to go back down to the underworld. So she's trapped in this patriarchal marriage which she can't escape. So that's another story, not at the introduction of patriarchy, but rather the strengthening of it.
And a couple of things. One is, and I'm enjoying this so much. Thank you so much for this. And I'm thinking of, this reminds me of an interview I did in the 90s of George Gerbner, who was the person who, when people talk about studies of TV violence, he was the person who did it. He'd been studying it from the 50s through the 90s. Mm-hmm. And he said that for the most part, people misinterpret his findings. That he said he's not against violence as a dramatic tool in Shakespeare or in television. I mean, it is a dramatic tool, just like any other. But his problem, he said, is you have to pay attention to what he called casting and fate, which is who does what to whom and gets by with it. Mm-hmm. So in a movie, a guy can shoot seven people and he can still be the hero, even if he shoots them in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But if a woman shoots seven people, the entire movie has to be about how could she do something so horrible. And And the story you just told me, and just like all these stories, really what I'm finally understanding 25 years after Judith Herman told me this, is what I'm understanding is that what that story is telling us is that if you're a male, it is acceptable, morally acceptable, and it is physically feasible for you to kidnap a woman and hold her against her will, and all the universe will end up conspiring to say, yeah, that's okay. She has to stay down there. And then I think about women who are stuck in abusive relationships because the man has economic power. And that is beautifully told in that story, that she took sustenance while she was there, which means she's tied to him.
Yes.
It is absolutely a brilliant telling of she's literally in hell. Well, not hell, but whatever it's called in Greece, Hades.
She's in the underworld, yeah, however you want to phrase it. Yeah, and I mean, I think the knowledge of these stories is really important to have. And it's one of the reasons why I keep telling and retelling the stories. And there are all sorts of variations on it. Some of them have to do, I mean, there is there are a lot of stories about having children taken away from women. So the Lupa story in Rome is one of them. And there are many, many others. And that's a repeating theme also. And, you know, if you think about the world now, I mean, we in Australia, we had the stolen generations of Indigenous people who were removed from their mothers and families forcibly. We have the story of the Armenians, where there are stories in 1915 of children being removed from Armenian families and then raised in Turkish families. Or you get the stories in Argentina of the disappeared and the babies who were born in prison, the mothers were killed, and then the children raised by mostly military families. So you get the repetition of that also in the real world. And I think I write a bit about that in my novel Dark Matters. And it's something that it's a key way of changing the culture, because if you raise the children of the former enemy as in the society of the winners, then you don't have to do any propaganda. The children grow up and they think that they are part of, you know, the Turkish or the Argentinian or the whatever. And your education does it for you. Your cultural ambience does it for you. So it's a very secure way of changing the culture. And I think, I mean, you see it happening just throughout history and contemporaneously and all the rest.
And we see it also on a personal level. My father was very abusive, and one of the arguments or one of the things he said to my mother to help make her stay was, if you leave, I'm taking the children.
Mm.
And that's absolutely standard too. Okay, I want to go back. We only have a few minutes left, and there's two things I want to address. I'm going to come back to what do we do about this in a second. But before then, I want to come back to, you started with the Trojan horse, which I think was absolutely brilliant. And it made me think of something that I read a while ago, that there was someone who works with perpetrators of domestic violence. And he was working with a group of men. And he just asked them one day, so is there an optimal time when you're in a relationship when you can start beating your partner? And I mean, you can't beat them on the first date usually. And and all the men in the room started talking about it, and they came up with sort of an average of about a year. You know, you really have to have a commitment of a year. And when you were telling the Trojan horse story, I was thinking about, in some ways, the Trojan horse is in many ways this a central metaphor of all of patriarchy, that we promise you gifts. I mean, that's a classic thing in an abusive relationship. You or in a cult, you love bomb people, you give them things, but it ends up the gifts are literally hollow. Anyway, I thought that was absolutely brilliant that you began with that when we talk about patriarchal mythology. Well,
it's interesting because with my latest book, Vortex, The Crisis of Patriarchy, the Trojan horse is a central theme to that book. And it is that the story is that there are many so-called gifts that are offered to people who are oppressed, who then go on with the idea. They think, oh, yes, we'll go down this track. They then discover later when it hits them in the face that it wasn't that good after all. And it is a continuing theme and a continuing method, strategy of patriarchy to create this fake gift that turns bad.
Yeah, and by the way, I just want to tell people that they should read that book. It is really good. And then the last thing is we've got just like a couple minutes left. And if stories can be told in that direction, I mean, is there any hope for retelling stories, for reclaiming stories or even creating new stories that have different casting and fate? I mean, how do we change all this? What do we do?
Well, there are people like me who are poets who keep telling these stories, so that's one possibility. The people who've had their stories stolen from them, many of them are reclaiming their stories and retelling them and making sure that their children know them. That's happening in a very strong way in Australia amongst Indigenous peoples, but I also see it happening amongst immigrant people. Peoples who have come to Australia and then lost their culture but that now are reclaiming it. And I think this is something that is necessary. Women are also doing it. There is a very big movement of women who are looking at ancient history and who are telling stories of women throughout history, women who've been written out, so creating female names instead of male names in the history books, or rather, you know, maybe trying to increase the number of female names because the men still predominate. These stories can be told in huge numbers of ways, whether it's through books or film or theatre or opera or song or, you know, these art, all of these are means of telling the story and we just have to have the possibility of doing that, and there have to be more of us prepared to put ourselves on the line to tell the stories.
Well, thank you so much for all of that, and thank you for all of your tremendous work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dr. Susan Hawthorne. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you very much, Derek. It's been a great pleasure to talk